You will follow, and you won't have escaped Vandalia Street at all. You'll be no different from the ones that come, and you'll have to make the same awful decisions that they have to make. She wondered if it was Vandalia Street he had meant, and then remembered dimly the arguments about some money, some ancient, long-forgotten money owed somewhere. Abel nodded and reached for the petition, and he and Janice signed, and the woman thanked them and left. They looked forlorn when she left them. They were standing very close to each other, as she had seen children do who are playing in a strange place in which there might be sudden corners that were unfriendly. For some reason, she too felt sad. Very sad and very tired. As she drove home, she thought how tired and confused Janice and Abel must have been. Janice had forgotten to take up the argument over Marshall. 22. Marshall's new letter lay where his mother had filed it meticulously for answering. We are all to blame for conditions which have produced such poverty. How can I tell the people here that we didn't know what was happening to them, that no one I ever knew had lived with fear, with despair, that I had to come down here and see before I could believe? I feel guilty and ashamed because of all the things I had, the comfort and the luxury that dulled me, that dulls my family to the whole world crying outside my safe and sheltered little neighborhood. If it hadn't been for that black activist coming up to talk to us at school, I would have gone on thinking that justice in America had been bought out by the middle class forever, that no blacks wanted our help. William had raged over the letter for half an hour. I'm sorry, I dulled his sensibilities with luxury? It's a mistake I can remedy. Who the hell does he think he is? Because Margaret had only been hurt and was not angry, she had tried to placate William. And in the end, she had gotten him to laugh a little at the picture that Marshall had sent in the letter. There he stood in the field. He was facing the camera, his shirt off, his hand raised to shield his eyes from the murderous sun. Around him was something growing. It looked like cotton, and he was holding an ancient hoe. In the background, on a little rise, was a wretched, crumbling cabin. "Hoein' cotton," William said and sucked his tongue. I had to hire a man to help me with the yard work because he could never find the time. It was Marshall's letter to Janice and Abel that brought Margaret to rage. Abel handed it to her without comment when she came by to take Janice to the doctor, and she took the letter carefully from him, studying his face as she did for clues. Janice had come up and had begun to say something, but Abel had stopped her and the two of them had just stood, waiting, posing as deaf and let her see nothing. She hated this deaf role they took when they were hurt. Surely over 40 years of giving had entitled her to more. Marshall's hand was hurried and irregular. A young hand. The character in the letters was still forming. The lines of letters were now loose, now crabbed, now slashing, and now hesitant. Well, here I am in the old South. It's like another world. I suppose Mother has told you why I am down here and what we are doing. In setting up the freedom schools and giving assistance and advice to the small local black churches, we are hoping to bring these forgotten people into modern society. These beautiful people have been silent for too long. Now they are crying out, and America must be taught to heed them. Margaret's eyes slipped down the page to be stopped near the end. So I know you will be glad for me and will have greater sympathy for this work than the average middle-class person. Sharing your problems and humiliations has made me sensitive to suffering. The letter began to tremble in her hand and her face began to suffuse with blood. Janice was watching it redden, watching the tremor in the paper. Margaret began to speak, but the words were too quick. Janice only saw something that looked like humiliation. But the look of Margaret was too angry for it to have been that word, which was a church word. Then she just stood and tapped the paper with her finger because she was angry. Janice could no longer control herself. You sent him away! You sent him away into that poor place with all those dirty people? Look at them! Another picture. This one was Marshall, tall, smiling, and golden, standing on a precarious porch and flanked by young people, black and white, all of whom were wearing clothes that looked as though they had never been new. "Our staff," he had written on the back of the picture. It would have been comic had their faces not been so open and young and full of so obvious a pride.
"I..."
Margaret put the picture face down on the coffee table and took her purse off her arm. She suddenly had a picture of Marshall on the night before he had left. He had stood in the living room arguing with them. He had called them hypocrites. It must have been satisfying for him to have done this. He hadn't yet spent half a lifetime defending out of love things of which he didn't approve. "He wasn't sent, Mother. He went because he wanted to go. Of course we wanted him to stay and do something closer to home."
"What are you saying about this boy?"
Abel's face darkened.
"How can it be true that he would choose such a thing? I think his father has punished him. I think that William is angry because of something he has done and will not forgive him, but only sends him down there to be poor and hungry and a disgrace."
It was getting difficult for Abel to speak. The words were halting and stiff as though he spoke in pain.
"It is better to whip him. Whip him, and then he will cry, and it will hurt him, and he will be ashamed, but he will take this in his own house, and not with the whole world to laugh at him. William has sent him down there to make the people down there do to him what a father should do in his own house."
"You don't understand," Margaret said, and gritted her teeth a little. "This is Marshall's idea. He said he felt a call to go, just like a minister or a doctor does. And there was a group going from the university, so he went with them."
"To do what?"
Abel demanded.
"What will he do for those people?"
"I don't know, really. I know he wants to help them to... He says in his letters he is going to bear witness."
"They are going to court, then? To jail those people?"
Janice cried.
"No, Mother."
And the tightness ground tighter in Margaret's chest. Her jaws were aching.
"He means to tell people, to see for himself the conditions down there, and then to tell others."
"Is it a secret that there are poor farmers? I always knew that. My father knew it too, and that is why they sent me away to learn a trade. Tell him to come home now. I can tell him all the things about being poor, and then he won't have to be so dirty and hungry, and he won't have to live in a cockroach house, bad with rats, bad with rain that comes in on the bed. Tell him his grandfather knows all these things."
"But, Father, I think he'll say that he wants to work with the poor, to help them because they need so many things."
"So the poor need," Abel said. "Then..."
The hand trembled and then cut like a curse.
"I am the poor. I need. Do you tell him to look far away, to see with his good eyes all the way to...
And he broke the Indian name of the town to pieces in his hands.
"When poor is here, we are the poor."
Janice's own hands came up, but not to speak. She was biting a knuckle. Her eyes widened and locked at the word. Then she began to argue.
"That isn't now. That was before in..."
Abel waved her idea away.
"Not poor in money. I know it. I know it. Not in money. Poor in world thing. To do, to say, to know. In the world."
Janice began to cry. For a minute, her husband and daughter stood back, embarrassed. She could not see if they were speaking or not, so she spoke herself.
"I wish Marshall was like that nice man they had at the party. Deaf have hearing for children. That can't be helped. But the hearing go away and only a few stay not deaf, not hearing, to try to make a way in the danger places where the deaf have to cross over. You should be ashamed to let him go with the poor and dirty strangers. You took him away from us and you never even taught him sign. If you made him learn sign, he can be ready to help us and be with us and all the deafs who are not helped in the school where people just want them to look like hearing."
"Yes," Abel said, and she saw him and stopped. "Now he is down there and he will learn all things, 100 other things to work and make for strangers he will never know again."
Janice shook her head, and there was a trace of a hook in the fingers she held up to speak.
"He said we were humiliated."
An echo from Abel.
Yes, he said that. In the letter, he said it. This is not true. Our family is good, and we are proud, and we were never humiliated and never made a problem. Who told him this? Who told him we were humiliated? Who told him we made a problem?
You were never a problem, Margaret said tightly. Not for him.
And you? You too. You had a happy life too. No problems were in it.
There was an icy cold moment of remove as Margaret watched her hands speaking, and suddenly they were speaking as they must have in childhood, without any sound in her head, without any consciousness of words before the true sign.
Have you forgotten a girl arguing with a coffin maker? Wasn't there a young girl telling her mother's female troubles to a strange doctor, and didn't she have to explain his answers without truly knowing what they meant? Wasn't it every day?
She stopped, and suddenly her face went pale with shock. Then she shook her head quickly as though she had been hit by something.
I'm sorry, very sorry.
The sorry thumb trembled.
I never meant to say that. Forgive me, please excuse me. I'm just tired and upset today. I'm sorry.
She sat in the car and listened to herself breathing, like a runner after losing a race. As desperately as she wanted to start the car and get away, she was afraid to drive just now. Her hands and mind were being pulled and thrown in spasms of anger and shame, all independent of her will. She tried to think, at least to see into her own feelings and recognize the thoughts, but all that came to her had already been repeated over and over all down the walkway and into the street and around the car to open the front door.
What have I said? What have I said? What have I said?
She knew she would have to drive away. Janice and Abel would be looking out the window because her leaving had been so hurried and confused. If they saw her sitting in the car, just sitting, they would be down the walk in a minute to find out what was wrong. Carefully, she took off the emergency brake and eased the car out, and slowly, slowly on down the street. If only there was some place to go now with this lovely new car that William had bought for her. If there was only someone, some psychiatrist or minister or friend or husband or mother or father to whom she could tell what she had done and who would understand. Not forgive, not advise, only listen and understand. Her own minister had gone to the easier side long ago. No doubt he was this minute in the church recreation hall organizing some teenage seminar or other, in which earnest, angry young people would declaim about their generation's rejection of values it had never sounded. He was a popular minister. And why not be on the winning side? Marshall's friends were so unwounded it must be a relief to deal with them. If she told the popular young minister about her parents, he would quote the new morality. You have to live your life. If they can't adjust, well, that's their problem. How easy it would be for him to tell her to sacrifice that in which he recognized no value. Her mind paused briefly and then passed over the deaf minister. Abel was too well known at church and his position meant too much to him. News of a visit would surely get around and there would be questions. Deaf communities might form in cities, but they were still each a small town in itself, with all the small town time to pick threads and knot and embroider rumor, and moves to feel again and again at the knotted underside of feuds and wrongs and jealousies. There was nobody, really. And if someone existed for her, all wise and uninvolved, what would she say after all? She came out on Webster Avenue and for no particular reason found herself crossing Webster and turning down toward Vandalia Street. She continued to follow Vandalia until she was back in the old neighborhood. She had no idea why she continued to drive on and on toward ever more familiar streets, or what she intended to do when she finally came to her street. Their street. But she was aware that her hands no longer trembled on the steering wheel, and that she had lost the feeling of panicky urgency at the stoplights where she had waited her time with the civilized, patient trust of the city driver. She crossed Carver Avenue, but it was barely recognizable. Familiar stores were gone. The huge furniture store in which she had always looked so longingly on her way to school and back was gone. And in its place were many small stores, all jammed together with a dumpy, hopeless look to them. And there were Negroes, only Negroes all around. She crossed over, continuing down Vandalia slowly. It was all the same. It was all changed. It was the way a dream would change things, strange eyes staring from a familiar face. The street was absolutely bare of commerce. There were no push carts, sidewalk merchants, pretzel men, peddlers, beggars, paper boys with loaded wagons, handbill passers, sidewalk preachers, or women in sag-hem house dresses haggling the evening meal. A few cars were parked at various places along the street. A few children were out running among the alleys, and women were at the windows for whatever breeze might have lost itself on its way from the river. And they were black. Women, children, old men scattering the stoops, all black. How long had it been since she had seen this street? Where had all the other people gone? She began to count the years in disbelief. I was pregnant with, yes, with Marshall. It's almost 20 years since I came here last. It gave her a hollow feeling that she had lived in this city for so many years and had never come this way, had never had a single errand nearby that would have taken her. And then she remembered Janice's honoring day. They could have come back and seen all these streets and this, where she had spent the first 20 years of her life. It wasn't fitting, not on that day. It wasn't fitting any day, to revisit places where you have been wronged or shamed or unhappy. She had argued with Marshall about it during the vacation, his preoccupation with misery. Doesn't it make you feel guilty that a family in Vietnam could live on the food we throw away? I've told you all to clean your plates. It isn't your father and I who waste the food in this house. You're missing the whole point. The fact of our overconsumption, gorging ourselves while others are starving. I thought the point was that we should be grateful for the food we have and proud of your father because he has been able to give it to us and thankful that our country is rich enough to feed its people. Do you know how many of our people are hungry? Does it help the poor when we have dissension at our table? That had made him so angry that he had stalked out. William had begun to call him back but had changed his mind and only looked at Margaret and shook his head. He wants me to say I'm guilty and at fault, she said. I know that he wants me to take the blame for something, and unless I do, he will continue to go on like this. He says be honest and take the blame. But if I am honest, I can't see any to take. Next time, I'll just say I did it, whatever it is, and maybe we'll have a peaceful meal.
You know better than that, William said. He wants to be a saint, and we are not the kinds of parents saints have. We would be better if we were, afflicted.
Abel had said, we are the poor. And now Margaret thought, I am the afflicted. She had ridden past the place. She turned at the next corner, hoping the old eyesore would be where she had left it so gladly when she had left the neighborhood. She turned the corner again, and there it was. As ugly, squat, and foreign, as out of place as ever. Almost abandoned. St. Casimir Catholic Church. The sign was gone, of course. It had been gone in her day, and everybody knew it only as the Polack Church. She pulled up beside it and sat in the car for a long time, feeling stupid and self-conscious. She had thought at first of going to the place where Mr. Petrakis had once had his pawn shop, but it had been broken up into two stores, and both were strange. Other people lived in her old apartment. The school was closed. The school grounds locked. This place was familiar, remembered. But now that she was here, what should she do? Sit and stare at it? At last, she got out of the car and locked it, and went up to the church, and then slowly up the narrow ridged set of steps and in through the peeling archway to the door. The church facade was stucco of some kind, with wooden columns and the archway and entry painted to look like stone. It hadn't looked like stone when the church was new. It looked now like a closed booth at a carnival. She tried the door. It opened and she went warily inside. The air there was rank and fetid, but images were still in the niches and a picture of the Virgin hung on the side wall. She looked gingerly into the holy water font. There was about a half inch of water in it. She thought, "Now I feel guilty."
And her mind summoned Marshall again.
"Now," she said to his image, "you can be proud of me at last."
It made her smile.
She sat down at the back of the church, alert for any movement or sound from some legitimate congregant who would discover her, a trespasser. There was no sound. She waited, wondering why she had come and what she would do now. The minutes went on. It occurred to her that she had come here to speak her piece, to be understood without being answered. "It's a foreign place," she said. She spoke in sign, a pinched, crabbed sign that mirrored her reticence even to herself. She began again, self-consciously, her ear still tuned for a footstep, a cough, a door opening. "I want you to know something."
She got up and moved closer to the picture of the Virgin. It was a poor picture, simultaneously crude and sentimental, but the hands were in a gesture as though the Virgin, too, was signing.
"I want to tell you about my father," she said. "My father is proud and dignified and unselfish. He wants to share in the world, to read and learn and grow. And all of these things that he is, he became too late for me. His accomplishments are all spread out in front of me, and instead of comforting, they only confuse me. To whom can I go and say, 'Help me?' My father has learned and grown and improved, and in his changing, buried the truth of my past from himself and from me and from my son."
The words exploded.
"You wouldn't write," she cried. "You were too proud to write, and I ended up arguing with the police when Bradley was lying on the floor, and I am alone to remember the coffin maker and the things I dream about after all these years. You went and changed, and Marshall never knew I had a brother whose memory haunts me along with the stench of the tenements."
She felt herself getting so angry that the words were almost out of control. Her hands were working in her lap as though so eager to use themselves that if she paused a moment to regain her calm, they would begin to fight each other. She closed her eyes tightly until the anger passed a little, and when she opened them, she saw Marshall in her mind and was angry all over again.
"You fool! Your humility has an arrogant, a pride that makes me sick!"
She used the proud sign widely, the manicured nail raking up the buttons of her dress.
"You watch someone's despair and think you share it. You watch someone's poverty and think you see it. If you want guilt, you spoiled, pampered, beautiful, beloved boy, you will have to stand without one single one of those crutch convictions of yours. No virtue, no single saving grace, and watch the ones you live with and will love for a lifetime cheapened and made ugly, and even in your own eyes. You want praise that you can afford? Your false poverty and false guilt and false humiliation. Your life freely and gladly given for the fashionable cause, the visible cause, or what is dying worth? How dare you sacrifice without asking me? You are so sure that your life is all yours to give, and that we have no claim on it."
She was too angry. The fingers began to scramble at the words, leaving one unfinished for the next. She felt she must have been running somehow. There was suddenly not enough breath in her lungs, not enough air in the church. She let her hands fall into her lap. This thing she had done had come to nothing. It was only a lunatic departure from the normal, decent day of a normal, decent woman. Margaret got up and smoothed her clothes, turning to leave. There, in the back of the church, was an ancient, black-clothed creature, sitting huddled against the wall and staring at her with frank, unfeigned fascination. She couldn't tell if this witness was male or female, and this disturbed her almost as much as the fact of its watching. In the toothless, caved, and wrinkled face, the eyes, unnaturally bright, did not blink. They followed her with pitiless and disinterested amusement all the long way back, step by step of it, to the door and out of the church. The street was still and the backs of the tenements empty. Windows gaped, but there was no one sitting in them. And the buildings had a closed look, nursing their own grievances. Margaret walked down the steps and went to the car. It lay dying quietly at the curb, the tires slashed, the doors opened slightly to invite a look inside at the eviscerated upholstery. From underneath, there was a slow drip, drip of some life fluid or other. It ran into small, dark pools, still spreading in the silence of the street. 23. Janice and Abel never dreamed that Marshall would take his side of the struggle to the churches. For a while, he did not write, and Margaret said that he had not written to them either. Abel thought that Margaret had sent word to him to stop showing the horror of his situation. The letters that they had were cheering and dead. They were like the letters Margaret had written when she had first married and gone from their beautiful, safe new home to the wretched poverty of that shack with William. The sweltering weeks of summer rose and were gotten through somehow, and other problems grew and flowered and died back with the summer. Abel had suddenly looked about him with new, stranger's eyes and decided that the neighborhood was beginning to show its age shabbily. They had the house painted and the porch fixed, and when they realized that these repairs would take most of their savings, they raged and argued at the world and each other until the work was done and the house stood shining and strong in the center of the block, like a good tooth in a rotting mouth. Then there had been a scandal flaring briefly in the papers when two children long in the retarded home were found to have been deaf all along, and another scandal when a girl at the deaf school was found to be pregnant. There were fitful attempts to form the deaf community into some association which would have the power to speak for it in these and other matters. But the scandals faded, and the thought died. In August, a social worker at the children's hospital came to the church and asked for help in learning sign. Her plea was interpreted movingly by the minister, and she said that she had been to other places to get this help. Many people seemed interested when she told how deaf children coming to the hospital were frightened by the strange surroundings and machines. In their fear, they could not lip-read, especially from the mouths of strangers. Many were too young to read the words written to comfort or instruct them. There was a flurry of enthusiasm for a group of volunteer interpreters to go to the court, the hospital, and the welfare department when there was need. But when the group had been formed, these agencies refused the volunteers because of what they called protection of confidentiality. Abel had given his name as a volunteer, and at first he wanted to get a lawyer to make a fight of it, but interest soon waned and died. Lawyers were expensive, and no one wanted to fight for the privilege of doing a favor, so the project went no further. In August, the dope addicts came around with a petition, and Janice and Abel signed it, thinking it was like the other one they had signed against the idea. The dopers had cleverly sent nice young people out with their petition instead of going themselves and showing their horror to the neighborhood. Later, Margaret told them that the people with the petition were themselves the founders of the idea, the dopers. Janice shook her head. "That can't be. You didn't see them. They were nice young people. The real dopers must have been waiting behind the trees or in car while the young people went to the houses." There was a fuss about getting their names removed from the petition. September began like a promise of peace. The hottest days were over, and it seemed as though the world might stop its wildness and get back to its work, its school, its rhythm. Janice was at church the first Sunday in September, wearing a new fall hat she had bought, and although she knew it was early to do it, she was eager to put an end to a bad and troubled season. She had never liked to come early to church and always arranged to have last-minute reasons for keeping Abel from it. And now they went in and sat down, giving quick greetings to their friends, just as the minister came forward to open the service. He was new and very young, and they didn't know how long he would last. The Reverend Mr. Martins had left 20 years ago after his wife died, and since then there had been 7 or 8 of them, all young, none staying very long, and one or two resenting the extra work that a deaf community imposes on its hearing members. The deaf had withheld their feelings with this one. It was hard to begin to like a man who might leave even before he had gone a single liturgical cycle, advent to advent, with them. This one seemed nice enough,
but he was not of the deaf. He had learned his sign and not been raised in it. Abel noted that, like all hearing, it embarrassed him to use his face and body, and so his sign had no wit. He could never be Christ before Pilate, and then Pilate before Christ, a 30-second speech made with expression alone, drawn quickly and quickly erased without a single sign. Hadn't the old pastor often done that? Now, Abel sometimes found himself dozing during the sermon. He didn't even realize he had begun to doze this time, but a sudden stiffening at his side brought him up quickly, and he looked at Janice. Was it time to go already? She was staring straight ahead, the little hat trembling, I'm afraid, on top of her head. I'm glad that this young man called on us for help, the minister was saying. His sign was satisfied. And I am sure his grandparents, Mr. and Mrs. Abel Ryder, are very proud of him and his unselfish work. He says in his letter that the people with whom he is working need clothing and canned goods very desperately, and, of course, money. He writes, anything warm and durable, worn perhaps, but still usable and in good repair, would be a godsend to us this winter. Canned food or boxed food that will not spoil is especially needed. He put the letter down. I think we might get up a special shipment. I will put a big box in the church office and we can leave it there throughout this month. When you come to services or for silent bingo on Wednesday night, please remember to bring those clothes which would be useful and any extra canned goods from your shelves. I'm sure that the regular members of this church will also. In case you want to send money privately, I will leave the letter and address posted on the bulletin board. Janice had gone a dead white. Abel thought she was going to faint, and so he held her elbow cupped in his hand, and the two of them stared straight ahead, throwing their minds against all the useless ways of escape. Janice began to get up during silent meditation, but he kept her, tightening the fingers on her elbow until he could feel to the meeting of the bones. Immediately after the final prayer, he enacted a quick charade, looking at his watch, feigning shock, and the remembering of some important thing, and pushing his wife before him to walk quickly from the church, faces full of the urgency of the errand on which they were going. They reached the back of the church seconds before the minister, and Janice, no longer to be held, broke and ran. Strangely, it was when he saw her running down the few steps and moving away down the street that Abel realized, felt, saw the completeness of his love for her. Never had she looked so graceless, so ridiculous, or so real. She was a large woman now. She had put on a great deal of weight since leaving work, but she didn't realize it and had kept to the little flowered hats she had always worn. This hat was perched up on her head like a hiccup, and beneath it her face and body showed all of the 49 years of enduring fear, failure, the death of a child, poverty, changelessness, change, success, betrayal, her own imperfections and his also. He knew he had to catch up with her. She would fall off her little stilted shoes or faint, and then there would be more shame than ever. He had spoken to the doctor about her fearfulness and shame once, and the doctor had only said, I would suggest counseling for her, but of course for the deaf. So there was only himself. He ran down the church steps and off down the street, catching up with her at the corner. They were both panting and gasping for breath, she half weeping and her hair already frayed out from its pins in gray wisps. The pain he saw in her face was almost more than he could look at. Not the father alone. Her hands did not need to catch breath. While she gasped for air, the words were flung from her fingers with stunning speed. Both of them! She too! How could she? They took that boy, that fine, good boy, when they had every money and learning, care, the world, every richness, every good thing, and they made a beggar of him. They turned him to be a beggar and sniffle in the churches for the scraps in other people's closets. We can never go to church again, you know that, never. It will be a disgrace to look at us. I want to go home and die in my house and never let her in again, my daughter who made him a beggar. He knew he must try to calm her. If they could get to the avenue, he would try to wave for a taxi to take them home. He looked up the street, yearning for some miracle to send a taxi cruising back on its way to the avenue. People from church would soon be coming around the corner. I don't know if it is so bad, he said.
and the words were almost motionless to soothe her. It's for them he is begging, not for himself. He's asking for the people down there where he is.
My hopes come true, then. Wonderful. Change the words on my grave if it says my grandson is a beggar. Say great fame, family pride. He is a beggar's beggar.
Those deaf who know, who are smart about the world, won't laugh at us. They will understand that he is asking for these things the way a minister asks for money for the church, for the poor.
He is down there making those black people's riots, making trouble, and he is being a minister to a bunch of deaf beggars.
Deaf? She had said deaf beggars. He was sure of it. What?
I said he was being minister to black beggars.
You said deaf beggars.
I said black beggars.
But the signs were too different from each other. He knew that her hands had said deaf whether she had wished to say it or not. Come, he said. Let's go before the people come. But they had to forgive Margaret. They had to forgive her as soon as they reached home. Their need for her was too constant a thing. Abel wondered if Marshall had written a letter to her church also. It was a richer congregation than his and Janice's, and he asked Margaret when she came by on Wednesday to take him to the Social Security office. Janice was hiding in the bathroom. Abel greeted his daughter and asked her about the letter as casually as he could. Her eyes recoiled as if from too great a light.
How did you know? And then, did your minister get one too?
And then,
oh, Lord.
Was it difficult for you? He asked. Are people saying bad things?
A few of them have been cruel. The ones I hated most were the pitying ones, the ones who acted as though he were some sort of communist. Oh, do you know that word? Communist?
Yes, I know it. And he smiled.
I forget, Margaret said. I keep forgetting that you've changed.
And she shook her head and then reached up unconsciously to check her hat.
Was there trouble for you?
Your mother, Abel said. She was upset, a little bit afraid of what the people will say. She doesn't understand.
Do you?
No, but I have been talking with some of the friends I have from Gallaudet. They read and understand things. I don't understand yet, but young people are trying to correct some of the evils in the world. What they think are evils.
Was anyone ever so certain before just what should be done?
Well, we have one virtue, you and I, a virtue they do not use so much now.
What is that? Margaret asked.
Loyalty.
Oh, yes, Margaret said. They use it a great deal, our loyalty. They depend on it.
They started out through the door.
It had been raining and the air was sticky and unpleasant. As they went down the walk, Margaret fought the impulse to turn and look back at the house. When they were getting into the car, she did glance quickly toward the two upstairs windows.
Janice was caught in that glance, peering back, and Margaret lowered her head and ducked into the car before her mother could move or release the telltale twitch of curtain and step away into the equivocating darkness of the house.
Loyalty, Margaret murmured.
By the time they came out of the Social Security office, they both felt tired. They had gone in mid-morning, and it was now well past noon. They had waited on a succession of lines and filled out a succession of cards and applications and been directed and misdirected enough times to retain a slight sense of dizziness, even out on the street. Margaret suggested that they have lunch at the new French restaurant that had just opened up near the farmer's market. It wasn't far from there to Page's, where, for this week only, the whole ground floor had been given over to an international display of crystal and glassware. Abel shook his head and said that he didn't want much to eat. He felt uncomfortable in large, expensive restaurants. Janice might have fixed a lunch for them. She would be worried since they hadn't expected to spend so much time.
If we eat a sandwich somewhere quickly, won't you come and see the glass with me? I won't be getting back this way before next week, and by that time it will be gone.
Oh, all right. If it doesn't take long. She had wanted to tell Abel that Marshall had his own heroics to warm him, but that she had wanted, needed, in this tiresome day, in this ordinary week of buying school clothes, chauffeuring the children, shopping, cooking, and cleaning,
One soul-stilling, restful interlude of tranquility and beauty and spacious serenity. She was yearning for a peaceful and unhurried time of communion, with something that was silent but not mute, for the discreet, muffled public place that wouldn't admit the suffering or embittered parts of everyone's life. The evenings at home were long now. William's anger at Marshall wasn't loud or violent. It was a low but constant undertone, like the half-heard vibration of some dangerous new appliance in the house. It was being kept at the low hum, awaiting Marshall's return and the first self-righteous word that he might utter. She thought she might be able to persuade her father to share this small moment of escape. As it was, they had a hamburger and a cup of coffee in a crowded and a noisy place, and with the lunch weighing greasily undigested like bad memories, they drove down toward Paige's. Abel was nervous and a little dizzy because he was worried about Janice. They had been out far longer than he had expected, and there was Janice, alone and still sick with shame, waiting in the house. He felt out of place anyway in the big downtown stores, and he had tried to pull back from Margaret's invitation without having to tell her these things. He couldn't imagine why she wanted to take him to some store. To see glass. All that fragile glass, all that valuable breakable glass was only waiting, perched on long glass shelves, to catch his sleeve in turning, or be rattled to the edge by his unknowing step. To be brushed, pushed, tipped, rocked. There were 100 scenes of humiliation and alarm waiting for him in such a place. She had pleaded, and he had to sigh and give in. She owned the car, after all. He had to follow her. It was another world, a haunting poem to silence. Light without heat, movement held resting, rest that moved, facets that burned for a moment and then went black as one passed them, only to have others, dark before, wake into radiances rimmed with a hair-thin rainbow. Of all the things that man does or makes, the art of glass seemed to Margaret to be the most beautiful. Everyone felt it. Few people spoke except in whispers of awe or delight. Margaret felt a powerful urge to speak with her father there, to share in their singular gift, words without the need to break the glowing surface of the silence. The bodies of men and women, angels, stars, flowers danced in their worlds of crystal. Visible winds blew across those worlds. The tides of seas ebbed and flowed soundlessly in the glass. Once he had asked her about the light. It must have been 30 years ago, maybe more, when she was very young. He had asked her if the sunlight made a sound. Wind did. That you couldn't see. Did sun? Did it hit the nail heads of the floor with a sound and warm over the bricks of the buildings next door, with some other gentler sound? She hadn't understood him then, and had laughed and said, "You don't hear anything. The sun doesn't make any noise." He had looked puzzled and said, "That's funny. I hear things in my head, things I think must be sounds. I always thought I heard that sound, the sun, on things, on different things. And there's nothing, none at all?" She had shaken her head, lips pursed with the righteous, absolute certainty of a first child. If only he would ask that question now. Now when she, too, could feel the high, clear note when the single ray of sunlight broke its silence against an edge of crystal. But Abel was impatient today, distracted by everything, distressed by the fragility of the glass and the closeness of too many strangers. So they didn't stay. Margaret straightened her hat and tried to make her face easy and pleasant, but there was a pursed, hard look of want around her mouth, and for a moment, seeing it in the small mirror of her compact, she was ashamed. He walked ahead of her quickly toward the car. She was being slowed by shop after shop that pulled her eye and made her turn for a minute toward each display. All the colors, textures, and designs, all the profusion held her staring. There were rich, warm furs in a dozen styles displayed so beautifully in the windows, handbags and hats and shoes, jewelry, in richness as austere as any poverty, fathering their mellow lights alone in their cases. She saw Abel's head losing itself in the crowd. She would have to hurry to catch up. Between two storefronts, there was a tiny alley, and blocking the entrance, a man was sitting on his coat. She nearly stumbled over his feet, sticking partway out onto the sidewalk. Her weight had been thrown forward, and she came down heavily on her left foot. Her arm out instinctively found the back of a woman's coat and hung to it for a moment. The woman turned.
"Oh, I'm so sorry."
The woman nodded brusquely and was gone. Before her, the feet remained. She wanted them to belong to a drunk asleep in the alley, and so she turned and looked at him, saying,
"I beg your pardon, I'm sorry."
But it wasn't the drunk. It was he. She had grown up and grown middle-aged, but he hadn't changed at all, not even his clothes. And he was here again with a bundle of cards this time, the manual alphabet and a sign, "I am deaf." The same hat with the same few coins as a lure. Then the sound of the light shattered the crystal. Margaret began to curse him. She used signs she had never consciously learned, and signs she knew and had tried to forget, the stunted, vulgar sign of the untaught deaf. For a minute, the beggar's eye traveled appraisingly up and down, almost with relish, appreciating the details of her correct and tasteful exterior. A well-fed matron unacquainted with life's hard edges. She had given herself away. Then he smiled crookedly and answered with the single gesture universally used by deaf and hearing alike. The single finger, pugnaciously. There was nothing to do then but turn and walk on. Abel saw his daughter coming toward him, and for a minute he was frightened. The outfit looked the same, the studied look of her was the same. What was different was in her face, which she always wore in public with the same too careful control. She looked, with all her neat perfection, like the fugitive of a bombed city. "What?" he signed unconsciously as she came toward him. Her public self was fighting whatever had happened in the minute since he had last seen her walking and looking and stopping and walking again. She would not answer. The car was parked in a lot, and they went in together, Abel to the car to wait and Margaret to pay the lot attendant. He saw her at the little office fumbling in her purse for one thing and then another. It wasn't like her. His Margaret never seemed to be caught, to be vulnerable, or even for a moment humanly off-poised with the ordinary discomforts of existence. His Margaret was safe, magically immune from the broken heel, the flat tire, the torn stocking, the drink upset, the sudden rain, the absence of Nichols. It was harder to love such a person than it was to love someone like Janice, whose clothes were never, never right. But he did love his daughter, even though she was a little frightening sometimes. And now he was frightened in a new way, because when Margaret's face was not drawn smooth and blank to the world, who could know if a chair would hold or a car go, or the street lead him home as it had always done before? He thought pettishly, "I'm too old to be given all this now. It's too late to have all these changes made in the people I need." Then he wondered what it could be that had changed her in a minute. Surely it wasn't longer than that. He had walked on ahead to keep her from stopping at every store, and he had looked back now and then and seen the hat coming along toward him, slowing a little bit when she was caught by some window, pausing and then jouncing on toward him. Before he crossed the street, he had looked again and seen her coming no more than half a block away, and he had crossed and gone up to the entrance of the lot to stand and wait. And then she had come, changed. She had finished paying and was coming toward the car, fighting more desperately now. Rage or tears, he couldn't tell which. She got in and slammed the door so that every screw, bolt, and gear remembered itself. Abel, seeking something that would make her be his Margaret again, said, "Why aren't you taking your other car, the new one that William got for you?"
"It's in the shop," she said stiffly, "to be fixed."
"What happened now, on the street, to make you act so bad?"
"I met someone."
"Who?" "A fit parent for a saint."
24. Marshall had decided that he wouldn't be going back to school. He had called them collect to tell them. School was artificial, he said. The work he was doing now was real. William was quietly acid, and Margaret, listening on the extension upstairs, said little.
"Mother, you sound so sad. I wanted you to be happy, knowing that I'm doing work that counts, where I'm needed, that I don't have to live a hypocritical, dishonest life. I thought you would be happy about that.
What a pity that with all those morals your understanding should have improved so little, William said, and hung up.
All that Margaret could say before she said goodbye was that she knew that he felt he was doing the right thing, and that she hoped he would find fulfillment in it. The words sounded like something printed, and she thought crazily of herself sitting on the street holding a packet of cards printed with those words, a cap held out for money and the old tweed coat of the deaf beggar. On the other side of the card might be the manual alphabet, and the extra thing they always added, gobble bobble blobble to the less fortunate, blub 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 to the disabled and handicapped. She hung up the phone and sat there crying. And Marshall had written another letter. Janice and Abel stood dressed and ready to go to a meeting, holding out the letter he had written. Margaret knew it as she came into their house. Something in the way they held themselves, in their closeness to each other, sleeves touching. A unity, half attack, half defense. And she felt like the old dog that the boys used to tease back on Vandalia Street, with its dented face and Ricketts' twisted legs. The days of that dog were full of shocks and deceptions, firecrackers, tearing bags of water. When it had been harried beyond its endurance, it had attacked itself and died, its teeth buried in its own leg. Here was a vision, a sharp memory of that forgotten dog 30 years later, looking up at her from a gutter that the mind had saved for some mysterious purpose of its own.
"Who is society?" Abel asked. He was reading from the letter.
"I don't know," Margaret said. "I don't think he knows either."
"Well, it is dishonest," Abel said. "Marshall says it is corrupt." He spelled it elaborately.
"I know," Margaret said. "Marshall has always been too modest to include himself in his hardest judgments about society."
"Well, if it is us, he thinks we lie and make evil wars and do evil things every day."
"I know that too," Margaret said. "But the only serious lies I ever told were about him. I thought if he ever reconsidered and wanted to come back and maybe work with his father, I didn't want that way closed to him, so I lied to a few people about his being down there."
She did not mention that she had also lied to them. "He said that William puts people out of work."
"I think William's work has given the world more good than evil, but no one really knows. It will take 100 years to prove if automation has more good than evil in it for mankind, or more evil than good. There is no way of knowing now."
"What does Marshall want us to do?" Abel asked.
"I think he wants us to be guilty because of the poor. He wants us to be ashamed. He wants us to end poverty and despair."
Abel's eyes widened. He looked around him, at Janice and at Margaret. Then he smiled slowly. "Well," he said in long, elegant sign, "we did that."
"He wants it ended right now, for everyone."
"Then we can only do one thing," Abel said to Janice.
"I think I know," Janice said, and began to smile. "Crying is a sign. Laughing is a sign."
"It's like sign," Abel said. "It's very much like sign."
One by one, Abel, then Janice, then Margaret, then all together, they began to laugh.
Afterward. My husband, Albert, had been working at Colorado's Vocational Rehabilitation Department for some time when the director approached him.
"I see here that you haven't taken any in-service classes."
Albert had a full load of cases, testing and setting up training for clients who had become unable to work because of illness or injury, and for people emerging from prisons or mental hospitals. Some had never found steady employment.
"The state requires that you have this training," the director said. "So I have signed you up for a program being run out of the university at Boulder. It's a 4-day in-service about deafness."
When Albert began to protest, the director said,
"Don't worry, it won't be a problem, it's just a formality. We never get any deaf here. We've only had 4 since I arrived."
Albert went to Boulder for the 4 days and called me from there.
"It's fascinating," he said. "Deafness ranges from severe to complete hearing loss. People are born with it or develop it later, and the two outcomes are very different."
Most of the deaf are children of hearing parents, but those with deaf parents seem to have an easier time and are better adapted to the hearing world, strange as that seems. That language of theirs, the signs, is a full language with everything any language has. I think I would like to learn more about it when I get back home.
My own introduction to the deaf world had been classically negative. It happened in New York City when I was 11. The bus I was on had stopped in front of a large building. It was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. There they came, pouring out of the place, 15 or 20 of them, fingers flying, faces pulled one way and another, gruntings and squeakings from gaping mouths, all motion, no sense. I was terrified.
Who are they?
Oh, the bus driver said. That's the school for the deaf. When I got home, I told my parents.
Those poor people, my father said. Such a pity.
And then there was Helen Keller. When I declared that I couldn't understand a word she said, my uncle told me that I should be ashamed of myself and that I should pity her. Fear and pity. Just what we feel for Frankenstein's monster. I didn't tell Albert any of this when he came home. In those days, none of the Denver deaf schools used sign. All taught intensive speech and lip reading. Sign language was called gesturing and was forbidden during the school day. The only place that used it was the state school in Colorado Springs. Kids communicated covertly in the signs they learned, and with a sense of guilt. Albert began to take tutoring from one of the graduates of the state school. It seemed natural to him that any means of expression that was normal for the deaf was what he should study. I came to be enthralled by sign and wanted to learn more. As we got comfortable with it, we began to sign in situations where hearing didn't work, in crowds, at concerts, and through windows. It was there that we realized how difficult lip reading really was. Because of that 4-day in service, any deaf clients would be sent to Albert. Soon he had one, and then another. The fact that there was a signing counselor was flowing through the deaf grapevine. He had 5 clients, then more. As more and more deaf people came to the office to see him, both of us realized how primitive our signing was. As time went on, we became part of the deaf community, meeting ministers who conducted services in sign, and being introduced to leaders in the different areas of deaf culture. With friends who were instructors in first aid, I introduced a first aid class for the deaf. These were the days before computers, teletypewriters, TTY, phone relay, and all the other assistive devices that are now so vital. Clients and new friends would show up at our door, and my primitive sign would be barely enough to have easy conversation. I decided to get a tutor for myself. I found classes. In one of these, I saw a big-handed Colorado wheat farmer struggling to put his fingers in the proper positions, wrangling with them, sweating with the effort, trying to learn enough to communicate with his deaf son. From that experience, I wrote a story called And Sarah Laughed, which appeared in Good Housekeeping. When I wrote to the magazine thanking the editor for taking what was then a courageous stand in defense of sign versus purely oral training, the editor answered that had they known there was a controversy, they never would have accepted the story. By then, we were also meeting CODAs, children of deaf adults, and I became interested in their challenges too. These children are often intermediaries between their parents and the hearing world. So often are the children of immigrants and refugees. The problems are even greater in the deaf-hearing situation because deaf and hearing languages are so different. The deaf parents preferred having their children interpret because the deaf community is very small, and the smaller a group is, the more gossip boils inside it. There was a shortage of trained interpreters who were not local CODAs. They are sometimes immigrants in their own country. Soon, I began working on In This Sign, knowing that I needed to write without using similes and metaphors that involved sound, and that I wanted to give an idea of sign speech without making it seem quaint or uneducated. I wrote a book about the CODAs and took it to my editor, Louise Waller, at Holt, Reinhardt, and Winston. She read it and asked me to describe it to her. "I notice that you get enthusiastic when you talk about that older generation. You really light up describing them." I went home and burned the book I had written and started again with Janice and Abel, and moved through the generations.
I had to start the story in the 1930s, and when the book came out, some readers brushed off the inexperience of Janice and Abel as back then, as though irrelevant to the present. The lives and experiences of Janice and Abel were what I was seeing in the late 60s and early 70s, and even in some places today. There is now an even greater divide between the upper-class and educated deaf population and its poorer, lower-achieving counterpart. In the 50-plus years since I wrote In This Sign, sign itself has changed, as all language changes through time, and there is also a deaf pride movement that has objected to taking anything from English, hand signs from English letters, for example. Modern technology has come as a liberating and life-changing phenomenon. The TTY and the internet have changed deaf life immeasurably, even more so for the deaf-blind. And sign has even come into the hearing world as a beautiful and useful means of communication. Where once it was used almost clandestinely in the bathrooms of oral schools, or quickly and furtively in public like whispers, signing deaf are now parts of plots on TV and in films made with main characters who sign. I've been asked why I am not enthusiastic about mainstreaming or putting severely deaf students in school with hearing ones. These children are given interpreters to tell them what the teachers are saying. Even with good interpreters, much is lost. Who interprets the playground or the hallway or the idle chat between kids that conveys so much of what we know about ordinary life? A deaf friend's mother died, and I was remembering her as we sat together one day. "I miss your mother's voice," I said, "that little rasp of hers." My friend looked puzzled. "Do people have different voices?" With all my years of being with deaf and deaf-blind people, the question still amazed me. Tiredness, love, irritation, smarminess, joy, all the emotions are present in sign. But to my friend, hearing people remained dead flat most of the time, showing only the simplest emotions on their faces and in their body language. What classes teach this? Who studies the shades of meaning in an intonation? In This Sign is inspired by people I have known over the years. They are as varied and diverse as any hearing are, and their deafness imposes certain limitations on them. These limitations do not impact their humanity, their wisdom, or their appreciation. My deaf friends are older now, as I am old, and we can laugh about that, too. Young deaf people are as wedded to their devices as young hearing people. They have a lot in common. Joanne Greenberg. This is Lisa Flanagan. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of In This Sign by Joanne Greenberg. This program was directed by Yvonne Russo. Executive producer Iris McElroy. Edited by John Marshall Media. Text copyright 1970 by Joanne Greenberg. Introduction copyright 2024 by Sarah Novick. Afterword copyright 2024 by Joanne Greenberg. Production copyright 2024, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.